You can turn in your Bibles to 1 Timothy 6, but I'm going to start with a story. And I appreciate, Jim, that you start with stories a lot of times. And I kind of got, years ago, I used to do a lot more of that. And I don't do it as much anymore. And I'm thinking, you know, it's Jesus told a lot of stories. And, probably should do that more. So I found a story that fits with the sermon this week. So, but anyway, I was reading this week about a fellow. His name was Russell Conwell. And he's actually one of the founders, if not the founder, of Temple University, which is down here in Philadelphia. And he was I'm pretty sure he was a preacher. And but anyway, he would go about trying to raise money for Temple University. And he would always tell the same story over and over. And from what I read, he told this story thousands of times, but was used to raise money to start the university. And he always entitled this called, it was called Acres of Diamonds. But as the story goes, and I've seen different versions of it, so maybe he told it different ways, but there was a farmer over in Africa who owned a lot of property, had land and everything that goes with a farm. He was pretty well off. And he started to hear stories from other places in Africa about people were finding diamonds. And there was a lot of money in these diamonds. And he's thinking, boy, you know, I wouldn't mind getting in on that. And so he decides that he's going to sell his land, all his property, take the money and the proceeds, and just travel all over Africa and find a diamond mine. And so he did that. And he went everywhere looking for this thing. Never could find it. Eventually was destitute. Some people say that he committed suicide, but he ended up dying. He was, he was completely broke. And we think, well, that's a sad story. But what was interesting is the guy that bought his farm was messing around on the property one day and found this rock, and it was kind of pretty and looked kind of cool. So he took it into his house and set it up on the mantle above, I guess, on the fireplace. And a couple weeks later, somebody walks in and says, I was just stunned. He said, where'd you get that? Just found it over here on my property. Here was one of the biggest diamonds ever found. And they found many, many more. It ended up being one of the biggest diamond mines ever. It was on this fellow's property that he'd sold. So I think the point that he was trying to make is that, and it's true for us today, is that, this fellow was discontent with what he had. And, he was always searching for something else, and it ended up costing him quite a bit. So we think about being content or being discontent, I think that's something that all of us probably face from time to time, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But let's go ahead and read the scripture first in 1 Timothy 6. Most of us have read through this before, and so but we'll go ahead and read it, and we'll talk about it a little bit, and then there's another verse we'll cover with it as well. It says, if anyone teaches false doctrines and does not agree to the sound instruction of our Lord Jesus Christ and to godly teaching, he is conceited and understands nothing. He has an unhealthy interest in controversies and quarrels about words that result in envy, strife, malicious talk, evil suspicions, and constant friction between men of corrupt mind who have been robbed of the truth and think that godliness is a means to financial gain. But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. People who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap, and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people, eager for money, have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. So Paul essentially is talking to people here who are discontent with their situation, and they're not satisfied with what they have. And first of all, he talks about this idea of this biblical knowledge, that they're not satisfied with what they understand already. They're not content with their biblical knowledge, and they're into controversial passages and quarreling about words and the meanings of those. And thank God we don't have anybody in churches like that today, do we? So, no. I'm just kidding, you know that. But, and we have to be careful about that because, we all want to seek better knowledge. But, I know I say this sometimes, that you know, it's not the things that I don't know that I'm worried about. It's the things about I do know and that I can't seem to accomplish that I know that probably give me more fits than the things I don't know. So, and again, you have to be careful about it because we want to seek knowledge. You know, God's put that in our heart to do that, and it's good. But if it comes to this, it's, you know, like these people were doing, they weren't content with just the basic knowledge they had. They had to find something controversial or dig into those kind of things. It was interesting, we were just in Michigan last weekend for the spring feast up there. And, you know, it's funny the conversations you hear people get into, you know, and it wasn't controversial like this in any way, shape, or form. But, you know, it's funny how you go from one thing to the next and it gets into the stuff you just don't know. And so I had the opportunity to give a what they call a seminar, which I'm not sure where, you know, I was a little struggled with it, with the idea of a seminar, because is that a sermon or is that a Bible study or is it something? But anyway, but we were talking about the resurrection, and someone brought up about the passage in Matthew 27 when it said that when Jesus died, all these graves opened up and these people came out, all the saints from the Old Testament came up and were walking around. And that's all it says. It doesn't tell us anything else about them other than they went into the city after he was resurrected. You know, who were they? You know, how come none of the other gospel writers write about it? You know, and there was a fellow there, and he kind of relates them to the 144,000 that he talks about in Revelation. And, you know, and then those kind of conversations went on the whole weekend, you know, and I remember we got into one discussion, you know, the angels that rebelled against God. You know, when did they do that? And, you know, where are they now? And, you know, there's all kinds of things like that. And, you know, and personally, you know, when I hear that kind of stuff, yeah, I want to know. You know, I want to dig into that and know and know and know. But sometimes I wonder if it's, you know, you spend all your time on something like that and you're not doing the things that maybe God has called us to do. And again, there's a balance there. I don't want to say that we shouldn't be seeking knowledge, but, you know, there's a point where you got to say, I'm content with what I got, and I've got to use what God's given me. Well, Paul's also speaking here of those who are not content with their financial status, you know, and again, that's one of those things you got to be careful. I mean, we always should be willing to try and do something better, get a better job perhaps, or whatever, you know, and jobs aren't always just about the money. Sometimes they're about service. There are all kinds of reasons to have employment, but we have to be careful about that again, and it has to be balanced with content, where God has you right now. Are you content? Yeah, you might want something better, something good may come along, but are you content where you have? And, you know, like Paul's saying here, love of money takes you down a bad road. You know, some versions say it's the root of all evil. And, you know, in the version I have, it says it's a root to all kinds of evil, because it seems to make more sense to say it that way. But it does take you down a bad road. If you have a desire, your money is your only thing in life, it's going to take you down a bad road. And we see a lot of that today in our country, the health and wealth preachers, we call them, you know, that, you know, you should be seeking to be well off, because, you know, especially, you know, the way you do that is that you make sure you're giving to your church and, you know, doing that. And then, of course, mostly the preachers in those churches are the ones that are wealthy. So, but, you know, it's a bad road to go down. And we understand that. And, you know, even outside those areas that Paul's talking about, you know, there's frustrations in life. There's times when we're not content. You know, life can be that way. You know, things don't work out the way we planned. And, you know, your dreams are shattered, perhaps. And, you know, maybe things didn't work out the way you thought with kids or your marriage or a job or, you know, your health even, you know. And, you know, sometimes those things are our fault, but sometimes things just happen. You know, there's no real reason that we can figure out. And oftentimes we perhaps can adopt I call it the Ecclesiastes type mindset, you know, where he begins the book of Ecclesiastes is vanity, vanity. You know, everything is vanity, but everything is, it means meaningless. It's everything is meaningless. Everything we do is meaningless. And, you know, we don't want to have that. And then, you know, it's a very, you know, Ecclesiastes is a book that's just very, you know, down to earth, if you will, you know, and basically saying, you know, you're going to do all this and then you're going to die. And of course, at the end, he gets to the real reason for our existence is to fear God and keep his commandments. So how can we, through all those things that we face in life, how can we be content? And let's turn to another passage over in Philippians chapter 4. And Philippians chapter 4. I think, you know, the Lord wants us to be content. And, you know, that's, you know, to some extent it can lead us down a road. Does it ever say in the scriptures, you know, if you aren't content, that's a sin? You know, I don't know, but it seems like it leads that way. It leads into things that are sinful because we aren't content. And but anyway, let's read Philippians 4, starting in verse 10. He said, I rejoice greatly in the Lord that you have last renewed your concern for me. Indeed, you have been concerned, but you had no opportunity to show it. I'm not saying this because I am in need, for I have learned to be content whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. And, you know, it's interesting that word content, you know, is kind of this idea that, you know, you have enough. It's sufficient. You know, some people would say maybe even self-sufficient, but I don't think it's really that idea. It's this idea of being satisfied with, you know, with what you have. And there's no need for more. There's no, you're not hoping for anything less, but you're just hoping, you know, you're just glad for what you got, and you're satisfied with that. And as you well know, Paul had, you know, the ups and downs of life, like probably no one we could ever read about. You know, he was in prison, he was flogged, he was beaten, he was stoned, he was shipwrecked. You know, he was in danger, as it says in 2 Corinthians 11, has this whole list of all these things that he went through. You know, he was hungry at times, he was cold, he was naked. You know, I can't even imagine that kind of lifestyle. But yet, he said he's learned to be content. Extremes, highs and lows. And you know, he says that he learned a secret, you know, how to be content. And, you know, I think all of us would say, yeah, I want to know that secret. And, you know, Paul gives it to us. And, you know, you could say, you know, drum roll, and here's the answer, verse 13. And he says, I can do everything through him who gives me strength. And his contentment came through trust in Christ. You know, all, everything that he had, every ability he had, every strength he had, all the power he exhibited, it was all because he trusted Jesus Christ and let him handle things in his life. You know, it comes from God through Jesus Christ. And that seems like, oh, that's such a simple answer. You know, how do we do that? You know, but it is the secret. And, you know, when we think of secret, you know, we think, well, it was something that was, you know, hidden and, you know, just all of a sudden revealed. And but it's not that idea. It's more the idea, I think some of the other versions say it a little differently, but it's this idea that you're introduced to it. It's initiation into it. You know, it's something that you learn by your experiences. You know, you learn over time and time to be content. You know, I often tell a story in our church, and, you know, forgive me for the people that are here all the time and hear me repeat myself, but, you know, years ago, you know, I was, you know, we had six kids, but we had five at a bunch one time. And, you know, I had a mortgage, I had a job, and, you know, it was the sole income because it really didn't pay for Mary to go to work. She was homeschooling the kids. You know, money was tight. You know, we lived very, very frugally. And there was times I was like, Lord, you know, I just don't have the money for this. I don't know what to do. And, you know, I would pray. And every time I would pray like that, that day or the next day, something would come in the mail, something would happen, that I was able to make the mortgage, I was able to pay the bills. And, you know, after a while, you know, even my hard head, the Lord starts to say, you know, just like he's talking about this secret you're learning, I learned from experience that I could trust him. He was going to take care of me. I didn't have to worry about that. I was content with what I had. Yeah, I had to work. That was not a problem. I was always trying to, you know, you're always trying to better yourself. But at least I was content to know that God was going to take care of me. And it was a wonderful thing. I just remember it. It was like all of a sudden, it's like, you know what? I don't have to worry. God's going to take, he's got my back. He's going to take care of me. You know, and it was good. So, you know, it's a beautiful promise. And knowing that you're in God's hands and that he loves you and that, you know, he's going to deliver. And he's going to do exactly what he said he's done. Well, to illustrate all this, I'd like to go back to a story in the Old Testament. And so let's turn back to 1 Samuel chapter 20. And, you know, it starts with a promise, a covenant, if you will. in 1 Samuel 20, verse 12. It says, "Then Jonathan said to David, 'By the Lord, the God of Israel, I will surely sound out my father by this time, the day after tomorrow. If he is favorably disposed towards you, will I not send you word and let you know? But if my father is inclined to harm you, may the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if I do not let you know and send you away safely. May the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. But show me unfailing kindness like that of the Lord as long as I live, so that I may not be killed. And do not ever cut off your kindness from my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth.' So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, 'May the Lord call David's enemies to account.' And Jonathan had David reaffirm his oath out of love for him, because he loved him as he loved himself." So Jonathan here seems to know where things are going. I think, you know, we see that other places he knew that he was not going to be king. In one place he says, "You know, you'll be king, I'll be your second in command." But, you know, so he's asking here that David would be kind to his family. I think you get the sense that Jonathan knew where it was going. And he made this covenant with him and this agreement with David that Jonathan would be kind to his family. Well, as we know, well know, Saul and Jonathan died on the same day as they were fighting in a battle. And then Saul's other son, one who did survive, his name was Ish-bosheth, became king. That's something we don't understand to think about sometimes, but there was another king of Israel after Saul, before David took over, and he was one of the sons of Saul. But then he was killed. And then Abner, who was Saul's leader of his army, was killed, and a lot of people that were associated with Saul were all done in. And so everybody with this whole regime is gone. All of Saul's family is gone. It's you know, seems like it's all ready for David to take over, and he does. And his kingdom is established. And then finally, he asks a question. If we turn over to 2 Samuel 9, he gets to the remembering, perhaps, this covenant that he had made with Jonathan, and this is some years later. But he asked this question in verse 1 of chapter 9. He said, David asked, "Is there anyone still left of the house of Saul to whom I could show kindness for Jonathan's sake?" So he's remembering this covenant he made. "Hey, you promised that you would take care of my family." So he's asking. And so, is there anyone left? So let's read down a little farther, starting in verse 2. He said, "Now there was a servant of Saul's house named Ziba. And when they called him to appear before David, and the king said to him, 'Are you Ziba?' 'Your servant,' he replied. The king asked, is there no one still left of the house of Saul to whom I can show God's kindness?' And Ziba answered the king, 'There is still a son of Jonathan. He is crippled in both feet.' 'Where is he?' the king asked. And Ziba answered, 'He is at the house of Maker, son of Amiel, in Lodabar.' So King David had him brought from Lodabar, from the house of Maker, son of Amiel. And when Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David, he bowed down to pay him honor. David said, 'Mephibosheth.' 'Your servant,' he replied. 'Don't be afraid,' David said to him, 'for I will surely show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. I will restore to you all the land that belonged to your grandfather Saul, and you will always eat at my table.' And Mephibosheth bowed down and said, 'What is your servant that you should notice a dead dog like me?' Then the king summoned Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, 'I have given your master's grandson everything that belonged to Saul and his family. You and your sons and your servants are to farm the land for him and bring in the crops so that your master's grandson may be provided for. And Mephibosheth, grandson of your master, will always be eat at my table.' Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, 'Your servant will do whatever my lord the king commands his servant to do.' So Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. And Mephibosheth had a young son named Micah, and all the members of Ziba's household were servants of Mephibosheth. And Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem because he always ate at the king's table, and he was crippled in both feet." So this young man had suffered a tragedy when he was young. He had a lot of difficulties in his life. And his dad and his grandfather were killed on the same day when he was 5 years old. His nurse, who had fled with him to avoid the war, fell with him, apparently, And somehow something happened to his feet, and he was crippled, and he couldn't walk anymore. And now he's living in Lodabar, which is, the word means it's a desolate place. You know, it's a place without pasture. It was not a very great place to live. And, you know, so here we have this young man. He's born to royalty, and now he's living out a life that hasn't really worked out as it should have. And we think about that, and we see that a lot in our lives as well. And it says David calls for him, and this young man, I can imagine when he's going there, he's thinking, you know, I'm the last one left of this family. You know, he's going to kill me. And, you know, I'm part of Saul's family. You know, I deserve to die. And he was afraid. But God, you know, moved David to bless him. He blessed him. And he gives him all of Saul's lands and possessions. He gives him servants to take care of him. And he gives him a seat at David's table in the, you know, in the palace. And, you know, that's pretty incredible. You think about how things change for him. And life seems really good. But again, things seem to go up and down in life as it did for Mephibosheth. And let's turn over to 2 Samuel 16, and we'll read a few verses there. You remember the story, the setting of this is when David, Absalom started a rebellion, and David had to flee Jerusalem, and he was on his way out. He was leaving town. And so as he's leaving, this is where the story picks up here. In verse 1, it says, when David had gone a short distance beyond the summit, there was Ziba, the steward of Mephibosheth, waiting to meet him. And he had a string of donkeys saddled and loaded with 200 loaves of bread, 100 cakes of raisin, 100 cakes of figs, and a skin of wine. And the king asked Ziba, why have you brought these? And Ziba answered, the donkeys are for the king's household to ride on, and the bread and the fruit are for the men to eat, and the wine is to refresh those who become exhausted in the desert. And the king then asked, where is your master's grandson? And Ziba said to him, he is staying in Jerusalem because he thinks, today the house of Israel will give me back my grandfather's kingdom. Then the king said to Ziba, all that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours. I humbly bow, Ziba said, may I find favor in your eyes, my lord the king. So and he comes across this servant that he put in charge of Mephibosheth, and you know, basically the servant accuses him of treason. And you know, we think, boy, that's a sad end to this young man's life, but again, that's not the end of the story, as David gave him all the possessions of Mephibosheth. So we'll pick up a little bit farther in chapter 19. After Absalom is killed and David is returning to Jerusalem, we'll see who comes out to meet him. In verse 24, Mephibosheth, Saul's grandson, also went down to meet the king. And he had not taken care of his feet or trimmed his mustache or washed his clothes from the day the king left until the day he returned safely. And when he came from Jerusalem to meet the king asked him, why didn't you go with me, Mephibosheth? And he said, my lord the king, since I, your servant, am lame, I said, I will have my donkey saddled and will ride on it so I can go with the king. But Ziba, my servant, betrayed me, and he has slandered your servant to my lord the king. My lord the king is like an angel of God, so do whatever pleases you. All my grandfather's descendants deserve nothing but death from my lord the king, but you gave your servant a place among those who eat at your table. So what right do I have to make any more appeals to the king? And the king said to him, Why say more? I order you and Ziba to divide the fields. Mephibosheth said to the king, let him take everything now that my lord, the king, has arrived home safely. So, you know, here this young man comes up to David and says, you know, David asked him, why didn't you go with me? And he said, I was going to try to go, but, you know, I couldn't. You know, he stole my donkey and Ziba stole my donkey. He betrayed me. And, you know, obviously you could see he was upset because it said he never took care of himself. He didn't. You know, he didn't, you know, wash himself. He didn't trim his mustache, and you know it says. And so, you know, he was obviously upset. And you know, it's interesting that he tells David, you know, just do whatever pleases you. And he submits to David's judgment. And you know, I just find this young man fascinating. You know, hear all the things that have happened to him in his life, and you know, he gets blessed, and he's not blessed, and he's blessed again, and but the whole way through it, he seems content. No matter what David says to him, he's happy with that. He's content with it. And, you know, he sort of figured I deserved death from the very beginning, being a part of Saul's family, and yet you were gracious to me. And David gives him back at least some of the fields. You know, maybe David still wasn't sure, you know, of this, but it seems to me like the story implies that he was innocent. And, but David divides the fields, and you know, this young man, Mephibosheth, says, you know, let Ziba have it. You know, I'm content. You know, I don't need all that. And, you know, my joy is in the fact that the king is safe and that I can sit with him at his table. And, you know, what a beautiful picture of being just content with what God has given me. And I'll just make a couple points here as we close this out, but, you know, things that we could learn. And, you know, as with us, things begin with a covenant and a promise. You know, we have a covenant with God through the blood of Christ, a new covenant. We serve him, we're in his presence, and it's a beautiful thing. But you know, when God calls us, you know, he calls us out of a place like Lodabar, you know, this desolate place, this awful place, you know, a place where there's no hope, no future, no good things. And we all understand that. You know, without the grace of God, we deserve death. You know, the scriptures tell us all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and the wages of sin is death. And, you know, he calls us out of that. He calls us out of this wicked place, out of this lifestyle that's completely opposed to him, and has made this covenant with us. He calls us out of the Lodabar, if you will, and calls us to salvation. And, you know, sometimes we go through things, yeah, and affliction perhaps is even sometimes good for us. It's good to go through things. You know, like Paul said, you know, I learned because the secret. You know, I learned because, you know, my experiences in life. In Psalm 119, verse 67, it says, before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I obey your word. And there's some point to that, that, you know, even when we go through things, God is trying to herd us in, trying to bring us back, trying to show us the right way. Psalm 119, 71, it says, it was good for me to be afflicted, so that I might learn your decrees. And that's exactly what Paul was saying. You know, sometimes it seems to go through things is good, but, you know, we need to learn to be content with that, because we know that God has a purpose in it. If you turn to 2 Corinthians 4, 2 Corinthians 4, this is one of those really, really encouraging passages in the scriptures. It says, therefore, verse 16, 2 Corinthians 4, verse 16, therefore we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. You know, all these things that we go through, all the things that cause us to be flabbergasted, or whatever word you want to use, discontent, you know, Paul's saying that those are light and momentary. Now, we don't think of them that way. I don't think anybody, when they go through a major health problem or face a death of someone, or, you know, lose their job, don't think of that as a light and momentary trouble. But in the scheme of things, the big scheme of things, it is. You know, Paul is saying here, you know, these troubles are achieving for us a glory. An eternal glory that far outweighs them all. You know, those are the things that we learn by experience. And he said, we fix on our eyes on, you know, not on what we have and the things that we see and all the things that we could have. But he's saying, you're looking beyond that. You're looking for something better, something that's eternal. You know, and I think that helps us to be content when we realize where God's brought us from, where he's taken us to, and all the things that we go through, we can be just, you know, content with that. And the second thing I'll point out is that God has given us a seat at his table, just like Mephibosheth was given a seat at David's table. Now, that's a great honor. Think of the honor of that. We dwell and we fellowship with the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Now, I could imagine all of us, I mean, we might not like the president in there right now, I'm getting to that, but if the president of the United States, even though he is, would invite you to his house today, hey, come down, I want to have supper with you, I think most of us would go, and we would think that as an honor. got to sit in somebody's presence like that and have a conversation with him. How much more the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, the great God of heaven. I mean, he's called us to sit at his table. I mean, what a great honor that is. You know, for Mephibosheth, that was a great honor, and it's a great honor for us too, because we do. We do sit at God's table. When we trust Christ for our salvation, we become his children. We get to sit around his table and be with him. And 1 John chapter 3, I was thinking about just quoting it, but I get myself in trouble sometimes when I try to do a memory verse. He says, "How great is the love the Father has lavished on us that we should be called the children of God, and that is what we are. The reason the world does not know us is that it did not know him." You know, we are the children of God. That's who we are. You know, what an honor to be at his table. You know, lands and properties and material goods and, you know, wages with millions of dollars, those are good things. You know, there's nothing wrong with those. There's nothing wrong with being, you know, having a lot of your heart's desires met while you're on this earth. I mean, I don't think God expected our physical existence to be miserable. I think he wants it to be good. But it pales in comparison to the eternity that we have with God and sitting at his table. Nothing compares with that than having a fellowship with the Lord. Being fed by the King, if you will. You know, you can imagine sitting at his table and him handing you bread and asking us things to eat. Pretty cool. So, you know, we could be content with that, knowing where we stand with him. So, Mephibosheth and Paul, you know, had learned to be content. You know, life wasn't easy for either of them, and maybe it didn't turn out as they planned it. You know, I think back when I was 18, 20 years old, all the dreams I had, all the things I was going to do, and, you know, most of that didn't happen. And but I'm content with that. You know, I'm happy with where God's got me, and, you know, in a sense that, you know, what I have is good. And do I want more? I want more of him, yes, but I'm content with what I have. And I think we should be too. So it's, you know, Paul and Mephibosheth knew the secret, you know, and being in the King's presence and you know, trusting in his goodness and his promises, you know, bringing that kind of contentment. So I hope that all of us can be that and enjoy that, being in the presence of God.